When Claire Hoffman was 5, she moved to Fairfield, Iowa with her mother and brother so the family could follow the teachings of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. A lifetime later, Claire returned to Iowa to revisit her childhood and find herself. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with Claire Hoffman about her new memoir, Greetings from Utopia Park, Surviving a Transcendent Childhood. Her family moved to Fairfield in the early 80s, and she was on the front lines of the conflict between townies and so-called gurus as the town grew and changed. She left Fairfield far behind as a teenager, but returned in her 30s to see the town and her journey to enlightenment in a new way. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. When Claire Hoffman was a child, her mother would tell her the story of the first time she met the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the way other women would tell a story of falling in love. The family moved to Fairfield in the early 1980s, just a few years after the Maharishi University of Management relocated there. In her new memoir, Greetings from Utopia Park, Surviving a Transcendent Childhood, Hoffman writes about her childhood in Fairfield and her grown-up journey to understand what it all meant. And Claire Hoffman is with me now. Hello, Claire.
Hi, Charity. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to go way back in time to that story that your mother used to tell you when you were a little girl about the first time she laid eyes on Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. What was the story like? What did she tell you?
Well, it really was like a story of falling in love, and that the sense of, you know, fate suddenly taking hold happened for her, you know, and it's true. It changed her life and it changed my life. But she, you know, she was 19 years old and she was at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and she was waiting outside an auditorium. A friend of hers had said, "Hey, do you want to go meet this guru?" And she had become interested in meditation recently. And she describes, you know, him walking by and stopping to say hello to her, and that connection, you know, him looking into her eyes as, you know, a profoundly spiritual experience, you know, a sense of total love and acceptance that she felt in that moment. And that sort of became the fire or engine that drove us to, you know, follow his teachings and move to Iowa.
Before that happened, your mother continued following his teachings and walking along a pathway to her own enlightenment. And she met your father along the way. And this was something that he seemed to be on board with as well, right?
They met at a transcendental meditation retreat in outside of Palm Springs in Southern California in 1974. And my dad was from Santa Cruz, California, and my mother was from Princeton, New Jersey. But they both were into TM. Although for my dad, it was really, he was sort of trying to clean himself up. He was smoking and drinking a lot, and he kind of wanted to change himself.
And both of your parents were looking for a new path. Both of them had really difficult childhoods.
Yeah, for some reason, I mean, that might have been what ended up connecting them, but they both had pretty abusive childhoods, and both of them grew up with divorced parents, and you know, on one side, I think my great-grandparents are divorced, so it's, you know, it's a long sort of muddled history, but they, you know, were there and felt kind of like they were connecting into something new and changing the course of their history.
This was not a happy marriage, and it did not go well. So let's fast forward a little bit to when you were about 5 years old, your brother was about 7 years old, and you're living in New York City, and that's when things really fell apart. What happened?
You know, my mom says that last year that we lived in New York, my brother and I didn't even see my father that last year. He was living with us, but he was out and drinking and partying so much at night that, you know, he was never around during the day. And my mom was just kind of struggling to figure out what her next move would be. And, you know, my dad had just completely gone off the deep end. And one weekend, our neighbors had invited us to go away upstate for the weekend. And when we came back, my dad had left a note and about $50 in cash on the table, and said he was leaving. He'd moved to California, and we got evicted the next day. So my mom was really in a tight spot. She wasn't very close to her family, and you know, all her friends that she had made in the TM movement were all moving to Fairfield, Iowa, and following Marishi, and so she decided that was going to be the best thing for us.
So you wound up, after a couple stops along the way, you wound up in Fairfield, Iowa, at the beginning of winter?
Yeah, well, it was January, so it's been a while since I lived in Iowa, but I think, is that the beginning or is that
No, that's the depths, the deep, deep, dark depths. Okay, so you arrived in the depths of winter, and the place you'd been just before that was Florida. So I know you were only 5 years old. You had a kindergartner's perspective on the world, but what did you think?
I was disappointed. You know, I think I had imagined living in New York and then in Florida and hearing my mom talk about Iowa, that it was going to be this sort of promised land. And I should say, I actually was born in Iowa because my dad was in graduate school at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. So I ended up being born there, even though neither of them are from there. And this was before we got involved with, you know, Fairfield.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we moved there, and I just imagined it would be this sort of magical place that would be like a storybook, and I'd be allowed to go outside by myself and play, and it would just be sort of endless green fields of joyous grass, I don't know. And it was, you know, like 4 feet of dirty snowbanks, and, you know, people at that time in Fairfield, there was a lot of sort of animosity between the townies and the gurus, and it wasn't as I had imagined it.
Well, and you moved to Fairfield, and as you said, I mean, your father left you with nothing. So you moved to Fairfield with very little, and your mom was working extremely hard, making very little money, and you couldn't actually move into the community of the University of Management. You lived in Fairfield, the town, and you couldn't go to the private school, which is what your mom wanted for you. So you went to the public school in Fairfield. And tell us a little bit about the animosity between the so-called townies, and they called you Roos, short for gurus. And this was a lot of tension, a lot of friction, even in the kindergarten class.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in researching this book, I went back and went through the archives of the Fairfield Ledger and, you know, and even national press around it, but certainly in the Ledger you see just this, you know, sense of outcry that Fairfield had been invaded. And it was entirely localized in our kindergarten class. So as, you know, my first day, kids asked me, you know, are you a meditator? And, you know, does your mother fly? And I said, you know, yes, my mom's a meditator, and we're here so she can learn how to fly. Flying was this yogic flying technique that Marishi said would create world peace. But, you know, I mean, everything about me felt, you know, weird and strange. And this was the third kindergarten I'd gone to in a year. And, you know, it just was, you know, the food I ate, the clothes I wore. I was, you know, I was just an outsider. I had come from, you know, New York and then Florida. And it just, I mean, I completely understand the sense of confusion for the people who live there to have all these people moving in from New York and California and Europe, you know, into their town with like pretty, at the time, wacky beliefs. And, you know, I think that had trickled down to the kids. So, you know, the kids at the public school would rattle the fence and scream at the kids walking to the private school. There was a real sense of division. Some meditator kids threw, like, hijacked my brother and threw rocks at him when he was at the townie school. You know, it was a real back and forth.
Well, and this was, your brother is a couple of years older than you. So this was even harder on him right at the start, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, and he was a boy, I think, kind of coming in at that age. You know, I think he was in second grade and, you know, being, you know, the weirdo kid from New York who has to come into this little public school. I think at first he was bumped up a grade too, so he was young. And it just, yeah, it was, he hit up against a lot of it for the rest of us.
Now, as your mom was working just to feed and clothe you and keep you in a place to live, she was also trying to pursue her own TM practice, her own transcendental meditation practice. And of course, she meditated at home, but she really, really wanted to get involved in this special course, the program that would help her learn how to, quote, fly. I mean, that was her ultimate goal, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, ultimate goal. She that was when moving to Fairfield, that was the big idea, if you will. You know, in 1977, Maharishi really sort of changed the course of his movement. I mean, before that, in the 70s, about 8 million people had learned transcendental meditation, and that meant just 20 minutes of saying a mantra in the morning and 20 minutes saying a mantra in the afternoon, and it was a pretty simple and mainstream technique. And then in the 1970s, he came out with this advanced technique, his TM Cities program. And Cities, loosely translated, means superpowers. And the advertisements from the time, you know, said like the powers of invisibility, the strength of an elephant, and the ability to fly. And flying was really what he focused in on. And he had a mathematical formula that showed that if large groups of people practiced his yoga flying together, they would create world peace. And it was based on that mathematical formula, which he called the Maharishi effect, that he had people move to Fairfield. It was going to be these peace-creating groups, this sort of capital of his Age of Enlightenment. And so being there, you know, with my mom, she wanted to be doing more than just the basic intro-level TM. She really wanted to learn how to fly, but it costs thousands of dollars. You know, I think it's about $6,000 now, and I think it might have been $3,000 or $4,000 then. So it was really important. It felt like, you know, everyone was doing it. They built two giant golden dome shaped buildings, a men's dome and a women's dome. And people would go there for about 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the evening and practice yogic flying.
The price tag for that program was prohibitively high for a lot of people, and a lot of people came like pilgrims to Fairfield because they wanted to be a part of it. What was the reason that it was so expensive? Because the Maharishi had a specific reason.
Yeah, I mean, what I was told growing up, because sort of everything with Maharishi seemed to be expensive. I mean, that was the most expensive, but nothing was ever cheap. And the logic given was that Maharishi said that for Americans to value things, they had to pay a lot of money for it, which has obviously sort of worked both ways.
Right. All right. We have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Claire Hoffman. She is the author of Greetings from Utopia Park, Surviving a Transcendent Childhood. She grew up in Fairfield, Iowa, and returned there as an adult to make sense of her lifelong journey. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Claire Hoffman. She's the author of a new memoir called Greetings from Utopia Park, Surviving a Transcendent Childhood. She grew up in Fairfield, Iowa, where her mother moved back in the early 80s with her and her older brother to pursue enlightenment, to pursue transcendental meditation. And Claire, just before the break, we were talking about the barriers to entry to that world. So a lot of people came to Fairfield seeking enlightenment, seeking involvement with the program, but it cost money. And I'm struck by both how hard your mom worked to make ends meet and take care of you and your brother, but also how vulnerable she was, because she was very hopeful, she was very trusting, and she had very little money, which is a very vulnerable situation to be in. Did you? I know that you're a mother of two kids now. Did you think about that? I mean, from your mother's perspective, how very vulnerable she was?
Yeah, I mean, it's been kind of an incredible experience writing the book as a mother now and looking back to the situation that my mom was in and interviewing my mom about that time. I mean, the thing that you're talking about, the hopefulness, was something I really wanted to convey because my memories of that time are sort of mixed, but, you know, my mom's description of the excitement and the energy and the sense of purpose that she felt and had at that time was just so big and so special and unique. And I think it probably is something, you know, I mean, it is something you hear from a lot of people who move there at the time. Just, I mean, people felt fantastic. They were meditating 4 hours a day. They had this huge sense of purpose. And it just felt like anything was possible. So there was all this excitement and energy. At the same time, you know, I mean, my mom is from a middle-class family. Her mother was a nurse. Her father was an engineer. She went to college. And, you know, they grew up in a nice house in New York. So suddenly she was, you know, we got to Fairfield and she didn't have a lot of work opportunities. She ended up having to file for food stamps, which was really humiliating for her. It wasn't something that felt good. And it felt really strange for us because as kids, you know, we moved there and we had felt all the hope and energy and excitement, but there was this other side to it of, you know, sort of, you know, standing on a precipice of something bad happening, you know, feeling like, you know, after we'd gotten evicted in New York, like, you know, were we safe? Were we secure? So it was a strange combination of, you know, hope and sort of danger.
Your mother was pursuing her own enlightenment, but she also firmly believed that this movement could change the world, right?
Yeah, I mean, everyone did. I my mom's degree of faith in that, you know, she's revisited that question. But, you know, I mean, at the time, I think everyone felt like not only were they meditating all the time for themselves to, you know, change their consciousness or become enlightened, but also to create world peace. So, I mean, that's what I mean. Like, the sense of purpose was just, it's kind of hard to describe. You know, there's so much energy around it.
How long did you spend at the public school in Fairfield before you were able to go to the private school?
I was there about a year and a half, maybe a little bit more. It ended up being kindergarten through second, but only a little bit of kindergarten and a little bit of second, and then all of first.
And what changed that allowed you to go to the private school?
Yeah, like the flying program, an anonymous donor from the movement came in and donated money for my brother and I to go to the Murray Shoe School of the Age of Enlightenment, and we were so excited about it, you know. I mean, I think it was ended up being like one of many guys that was sort of in love with my mother who did. But yeah, it was, I mean, we were so jazzed and excited to kind of feel like we were finally a part of what was happening.
And at the same time, you mentioned that someone also, a benefactor, paid for your mom to pursue the flying course as well. So all of you were embarking on this new journey around the same time. And tell me what a day was like at your new school.
Yeah, so you arrived and we started much later than the public school, which was number one, awesome. So it started at like 9:30 in the morning. And we'd start with singing songs, you know, sort of about Maharishi or about his science of creative intelligence, which was his life philosophy. And then we would, you know, start meditating, do a group meditation together as kids. We all wore uniforms, so it was very organized. It wasn't like a, you know, sort of what you would imagine, like a hippie school where everyone's, you know, all around. He really liked a lot of parts of sort of old-fashioned Western education. So everyone wore uniforms. We would line up. We would sing songs with our hands folded on our desk. We would meditate for about 5 minutes. And then the first class of the day always was his sort of life philosophy class, the science of creative intelligence, where we would learn Maharishi's sort of theories about life. And these, you know, there were some basic principles and words that he felt like were integral to understanding the world. And from there, you know, we were meant to kind of go into our regular subjects, math and science or spelling. As time went on, you know, and the years went by at the school, more and more every class kind of became a Maharishi's philosophy class, like the SCI. It kind of really started to invade every subject. So even though we were doing math, we would be talking about how we could see Maharishi's principles in those math problems. We would have a long lunch, usually. I mean, at one point it was a two-hour lunch break because Maharishi really emphasized that we shouldn't be stressed out, or it should be a really relaxed experience. So we'd have these long lunches, and then, you know, and at the end of the day, we'd end with meditation again and be on our way. So it was sort of a long, relaxed day, let's say, with a lot of philosophy.
You write about how the math program changed at one point to reflect, was it Vedic math?
Yeah, I mean, this is, again, like where I feel so lucky, because I have these memories of doing Vedic math, but then I went back as an adult and as a journalist and interviewed administrators from the school at that time, and they describe, you know, I mean, I'm telling you from a kid's perspective, it was kind of great to have this long day that was very relaxed and sort of loosely just learning this philosophy. But there were teachers at the school who saw something different, and what they saw was an erosion of basics. So, you know, for example, the math program, I should back up and say that Maharishi didn't live in Fairfield. So all of his knowledge and all of his teachings and, you know, the ideas that we were supposed to follow kind of were trickled down to us from donors that had access to him when he was living in India or Europe. And they would go to him and he'd say, you know, what would be great is if these kids start learning math according to the ancient Vedic system. And I can't even tell you what that was. It was a kind of elaborate, strange form of arithmetic that had totally different rules, and you said little mantras or sutras while you were doing it. And they introduced that when I was in the sixth grade, and it was chaos. They didn't end up keeping it. But for the teachers at that time, what they felt like they were seeing was just like a less and less time on task, if you will, you know, where we weren't really learning spelling anymore, and we weren't learning math. You know, it was just more and more philosophy.
Your memories of those years, the early years at the school, seem to be extremely positive. Tell me how you felt about it. I mean, I know that you were excited to go, and you mentioned kind of it's a long, peaceful day. There weren't a lot of behavior problems at the school, and you were approached always with love, right?
Yeah, I think what part of my motivation for writing this book as a journalist is that you see all these books out there about, which totally understandably, but are about people who grew up in these sort of fringe religious communities and they escape, you know, and it's like they were a part of it and, you know, to whatever degree they were deluded, and then they come out and they sort of see the light and they look back and see everything is horrible. And for me, and oftentimes it is, I'm not demeaning that experience, but for me, you know, that's not what my experience was like. I was in it, and it was magical. It felt really wonderful to believe everything that Maharishi taught and to be a part of a belief community where everyone shared the sense of purpose and a belief that we were changing the world. Those beliefs felt really, really good.
As you got older, when did you start to have doubts? Because the doubts did come.
Yeah, I mean, the movement started to change, I would say. So there was the external element of that where it was getting sort of, you know, Maharishi was having more and more teachings come out. So it was sort of like every aspect of life, you know, had some kind of layer of knowledge layered upon it. So that was happening at the same time that my dad came back into our life. You know, he had completely disappeared. I didn't talk to him for, I guess, almost 6 years, and he reappeared in our life around when I was 12 years old, 11 or 12, and he moved back. He moved to Fairfield briefly and then moved to Iowa City. So he was sort of this counter viewpoint to what was going on, and he was sort of critical. But for me, my sort of moment, like lightning bolt moment, which it truly was when I was 12 years old. It was in November of 1989, and there was a school assembly, and the administrator of the school called all the kids into this special assembly, and there's a lot of excitement. Everyone gathers, and the administrator is sitting on the stage, and he's weeping tears of joy, and he announces to all of us that because of our meditations, the Berlin Wall had been torn down, that we had torn it down. And for me, I just knew it wasn't true. You know, I knew that my meditations had not been extra special or extra powerful, and I didn't believe it. I felt like we were taking credit for a world event that had absolutely nothing to do with us. And after that, things started to look really differently for me.
Did you talk to anybody about that, about your feelings about that?
I don't think I talked to my mom about it. I definitely didn't talk to anyone at the school, because I remember sort of looking around and seeing everyone else sort of embracing and laughing and hugging, and some of my teachers crying. And, you know, I mean, for a lot of people, that was the sign that world peace was coming. This was the sort of, you know, the opening of the floodgates of peace. And no, you know, I think I probably talked to my dad about it or told him the story, and he kind of confirmed for me that it was nutty. You know, and I think I was lucky in some ways to have these two different viewpoints at that time in my adolescence, where my mom was really still a part of it and really a believer, and the school I went to was very much centered around belief in Marishi. But, you know, my dad just was, you know, he was sort of cosmopolitan and cynical. He lived in Iowa City. He smoked cigarettes. You know, he watched Saturday Night Live. He was a much more sort of plugged into the world person.
At the same time as you were kind of having this awakening to the outside world or developing doubts about what was going on in your circle, the costs for the different things at the school were increasing dramatically. I think you're sort of approximate with numbers, but when you first started going to school, it was about $1,000 in tuition a year. But then as you got into the junior high years, it was about $3,000 a year.
Yeah. I mean, there was a moment where Marishi just kind of everything across the board kind of increased. And again, I think it was all around this time, the same time. I mean, in order to go to the dome for these group meditations, you had to have a badge, and you had to have that badge. You had to have a new badge sticker every month, right? And that badge sticker went from $33 to $100 overnight. And at the same time, the tuition increased. And that's kind of when I remember this sense of like the heat really being turned up. I mean, my mom was already working all the time. We were on scholarship. At that point, we were living in Utopia Park, which was a meditator-only trailer park on campus. So we already were struggling, but then the cost of everything increased, and I felt like watching my mother, that she was on this like hamster wheel of enlightenment where she couldn't stop and relax or just hang out and be, because she had to work all the time to be able to afford the things that were supposed to change our life.
Well, and there's another part of this philosophy that I think it's important to understand. I mean, this wasn't just about world peace and enlightenment, but there's also something, is it nature support? The idea that if you pursue this path to enlightenment, that you will have material success that just follows.
Yeah, Marishi had this sort of slogan about living 200% of life that you heard all the time in the 1980s in Fairfield, which was, you know, that you would be living 100% spiritual success and 100% material success. So people who, you know, were doing well in business, who had a new car, who were able to afford, you know, the tuition, those were people who were experiencing nature support. And it was, you know, it was like a prosperity doctrine where it sort of reinforced the sense like, oh, you know, if things are working, that's because you're meditating well, you're maybe entering higher states of consciousness, nature is supporting you. And, you know, then you sort of have to ask questions, why is nature not supporting me? Why are we, you know, having trouble making our rent in Utopia Park? Why are we having trouble paying the tuition for the Marishi School?
And your mother, in this effort to support you, to make it all work, she pursued her meditation with as much fervor as she pursued working to pay the bills, because she did believe in that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that was hard. I mean, anybody who grew up with a single mom probably remembers them working a lot. But for me, my mom was working a lot and then also meditating, you know, 3 to 4 hours a day as she was gone. So that was really hard.
And you didn't see a lot of her. I mean, that's a lot of hours in the day.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I don't know how she did it retrospectively, just because I can barely get 20 minutes alone, and you know, I have help and my kids are in school, and you know, it's I don't know how she did it.
Wow. Well, we're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Claire Hoffman. She is the author of the new memoir, Greetings from Utopia Park, Surviving a Transcendent Childhood. She grew up in Fairfield, Iowa. Her family moved there in the early 80s to go to the Maharishi School of Management, or University of Management, and she attended the elementary and junior high school there as well. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm talking with Claire Hoffman. She's the author of the new memoir, Greetings from Utopia Park, Surviving a Transcendent Childhood. Utopia Park is the name of the trailer park that she lived in for many years while her family was a part of the Maharishi University of Management in Fairfield, Iowa. And Claire, just before the break, we were talking about this idea that if you pursue the path of enlightenment enough, if you dedicate yourself enough, then material success will follow somehow. And the prices kept going up for so many different things. There came a sort of breaking point in your family where your mom had to decide that one of you had to go back to public school. Tell me what happened.
Yeah, I mean, my mom, I just sort of was always doing math on the back of an envelope and trying to make things work. And at some point, it was just impossible. I mean, she was working part-time for the Maharishi School in order to pay for or to supplement our tuition, even though we had a scholarship. And she saw that, you know, there wasn't enough money for both of us to do it. And my brother was a little older, so she had him go to the school, and he actually went and ended up coming back and then went again. So that was hard on him. You know, I think he was sort of a really smart, sensitive guy. His name was Stacy too, which I don't think like was that easy going into a small town public school. And you know, later on in ninth grade, I also switched over, and I think it just gave us the sense, you know, both of us, that, you know, that we weren't, as much as we were there and had put time and energy into being a part of it, we didn't really belong. You know, it really kind of gave us both a sense of being outsiders or outcasts a little bit.
Where, in both worlds, though, at that point, because you didn't belong in the townie world and you didn't belong in the guru world either.
Exactly. Yeah, it really pushed us out, because, you know, I mean, I think at that point my brother was starting to rebel, and I'm sure those were all tied up together. And later on I did it as well, where it's like, you know, you aren't fitting the ideal in terms of Maharishi's vision, and, you know, but then you can't actually afford to be there, so you're over at the public school, and we didn't really feel like we belonged there either. You know, we weren't welcomed with open arms.
That's an understatement. Very, a kind understatement. But at the same time, you pursued, at least to some degree, your meditation practice. That was something that was always very special to you.
Yeah, I mean, part of this book is sort of about that process of separating the past and the history and the sort of dogma of religion, the religion that you grow up with, and trying to find value in it and the things that mean something to you. And for me, that is meditation. it was always this sort of gift for me and an ability to kind of separate off from the chaos of the world around me and to find sort of peace and tranquility and really connect to myself. But, you know, over time, so much got layered on top of that experience that I rejected it. You know, I mean, by the time I was a teenager, I wasn't really meditating.
I mentioned earlier how incredibly vulnerable your mother was, but I read about Claire's teenage years and it makes my hair curl to think about how incredibly vulnerable you were. And all teenagers are.
Yeah, yeah.
But there were a lot of scary things going on as you tried to find a place for yourself socially, experimentation with drugs and alcohol and boys and cars and all of that. I would love for you to tell us about the conversation that you had with your mom when you decided that you just needed to get out and that you were going to move to California. Your dad had left Iowa again, but you were going to move to California to finish high school there so that you could go to college there and have in-state tuition. What did you say to each other?
You know, I took my mom for a walk, and at that point, I had really been planning. And I would say, you know, as much as I know what you mean, like looking back on those times, I mean, I have two daughters. It's terrifying for me what the future might hold and what teenagers get up to. But on the flip side, there was a part of me that was very pragmatic and very sort of self-protecting. And I had kind of baked up this plan of getting out of Iowa and getting out of this sort of party scene that I had fallen into that was felt increasingly sort of dangerous and strange. And so I told my mom that. I said, look, you know, I need to get out of here, and I'm going to go live with Dad in Los Angeles, and I'm going to do my last year of high school there and go then go to college there, and I'll have in-state tuition to go to University of California, all of which actually ended up happening incredibly. And my mom was just like, no, you know, I mean, you can't do that. Your dad's not an adult. You know, he's never taken care of you ever. And, you know, he disappeared. Like, I do, you know, I don't trust him to take care of you, which I totally understand now. At the time I was like, okay, enough with like the divorce talk. Like, I have a plan. So she was really sort of hurt and heartbroken, but I think she also saw that I wasn't going to take no for an answer. Like, I was a little steamroller at that point, and that was my plan, and I was going to do it.
And there are a lot of years that intervene, a lot of experiences that intervene, but I do want to skip ahead to you as an adult, a very successful adult. You did go to college, and then you pursued two different higher degrees, at least two by my count, maybe more. All right. And, you know, you were a very successful journalist and writer and teacher and all of these things. And you look around yourself and you're in California, and transcendental meditation is getting to be very popular, especially in California. But there are some really famous elite individuals who are turning to these teachings and driving others there and sharing what meditation can do for them. And you have some real mixed emotions at that point. What were your experiences like as you were struggling with people probably turning to you and saying, hey, teach us how to do this. You've done this.
Yeah. I know. I've never taught anyone to meditate. I am not trained in the art of teaching, although my husband can barely accept that, but I won't tell people like my mantra. I think what happened with TM is what you see so often with American spiritual groups where they're sort of fringe and crazy. So in the 1980s, you know, the idea of vegetarianism or yoga or meditation, you know, or natural foods or organic. I mean, all the things that the meditators were into that felt like weirdo stuff became or has been becoming normal and mainstream to some degree. I mean, maybe that's the California talking, but to some degree. And, you know, what I saw was that, you know, people all around me were asking about meditation, wanting to learn to meditate, And I myself was sort of turning to meditation more and more, partially just because of having kids and being exhausted and really kind of looking for some sort of foundational part of my day to ground me. But also, you know, I mean, with technology, I felt like being constantly wired into the world, you sort of end up wanting to have that space or some sort of retreat. So, you know, I ended up coming back to Fairfield for a month when my daughter was a one-year-old, and so it was about 5 years ago, and taking Maharishi's advanced technique course, his Siddhis course, his yogic flying course, and it was, you know, it was a really powerful experience for me.
Tell you write about that experience coming back for that course, and the way you describe walking into that classroom is a funny word to use for it the first day.
Right.
I mean, you must have had some doubts. Tell us what it was like.
Yeah, it was, I mean, mixed emotions doesn't even begin to describe it because, you know, I'd spent a bunch of money to go there and I had left my one-year-old with my husband for 2 weeks to do it. And that was really hard. And so there was all this strain and effort in being there, and yet there was this sort of old teenage part of me that looked at the people around me and felt really judgmental of who they were and what they believed, even though I was there and sort of in theory believing the same things. And, you know, I had this whole journey with the idea of flying. You know, I mean, for me, it had seemed like just sort of the ultimate example of Maharishi sort of duping people. And yet there I was. And I really genuinely felt kind of vulnerable and like I needed something. Like I needed to have some kind of spiritual experience or, you know, to feel like I was getting out of my own head. I was kind of unhappy.
And you walked into the classroom, which is kind of a dank basement room full of grayish foam because it's been there a long time, and you sat with other women who were learning to fly. I would love for you to read a little bit from your final chapter of the book, The Flying Course. And this is in the second week of the course, and some of the other women have already achieved.
Right.
Achieved what they were there to do, and then they left. They didn't stay and continue to practice. They graduated and left the course. So read for us just a little bit of what happened.
Okay. It was later when we tried again that I finally flew. It was silent. I'd been meditating for hours alone in my room already that day. I wanted it more than anything now, some sense of shift. Now when it came time to say the flying mantra, I rocked my body a little and felt the mantra taking over. I decided to just let my body bounce. What happened next is for me beyond coherent explanation. My brain went totally silent and I felt like I almost blacked out. For an instant, I feel as if I was somewhere otherworldly, somewhere beautiful. It was that same deep darkness that I'd gotten during my best meditations, but bigger. For a brief moment, I felt like I had totally let go. There was a long stretch of nothingness, and then my head slammed against a piece of wood. So that's me experiencing yoga flying.
Right. So you had a real transcendental experience, though, when you did that. I mean, you really felt a powerful sense of joy.
I did. It was, I mean, it's a strange thing to talk about, but it was, because it was really personal in some ways, but I feel like I sort of was able to get out of my own head and the part of me that was judging everyone else and questioning what was going on and questioning the motives and have this really singular experience that felt sort of beyond logic or reason. And was really beautiful. And for me, that experience felt like an opportunity also to kind of connect with my mother and really understand, and I don't want to say forgive, but some version of forgive, everything that we went through, you know, because in that moment, what I experienced, I could see why she had been so motivated and felt so connected to this community and to these ideas, because the experience was really powerful and transcendent.
So what place does transcendental meditation hold in your life today, now that you've gone searching for a way to connect what you learned as a child with your life as an adult?
I mean, it's a work in progress. I mean, for me, this, for my connection to TM is sort of the ability to hold contradiction and have these two sort of almost opposing ideas. I feel a lot of disappointment and sadness about Marishi and, you know, the people who live there still, who struggle to make ends meet because of the cost of his programs. And yet I meditate every day, you know, just once a day. And it's something that feels very much my own and not a part of that. It's a quiet personal experience. And so it's kind of holding those two opposites, you know, letting go of the part of me that's critical and cynical and judges the past of the movement, and sort of staying connected to some sense of spirituality.
But your cynicism seems important, too, because a lot of people got hurt because they didn't question enough.
Yeah, I mean, it's been hard to watch. I mean, first of all, as I mentioned, you know, when I go back, you know, I mean, the campus has changed. It's a different movement today. And, you know, the town is much more integrated. Fairfield is much more a place where the townies and the gurus coexist happily. And there's a lot that is working there. I mean, at the same time, there's people, faculty and staff at the university who've been there for 40 years and, you know, are really barely making ends meet. They're living their life in service of the movement. And, you know, I mean, when Marishi died, there were reports in most newspapers that his fortune was around $4 billion. And I find that hard to reconcile. You know, I mean, there's a lot of money that has gone into that movement, and I haven't seen a lot of it come out and support, you know, people that are on the staff or faculty, people who've given their lives to it. You know, and by the same token, there are the kids who grew up in the Marishi School of the Age of Enlightenment who, you know, suffered this just incredible disenchantment. They thought the world looked one way, and when they lost faith in Marishi, you know, that sense of disappointment and disillusionment was heartbreaking. And there's lots of kids who've turned to drugs. There's kids who've turned to suicide. You know, I mean, there's a lot of kids who are successful and are doing great and who would also credit meditation. But I just think it's complicated, and it's not so much cynicism in that sense of just feeling like understanding that that's part of the package.
Claire, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Charity, thank you. I loved it.
Claire Hoffman is the author of Greetings from Utopia Park, Surviving a Transcendent Childhood. She wrote about growing up in Fairfield, Iowa, and also her return there as an adult. Talk of Iowa is produced by Lindsay Moon, Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, and Emily Woodbury. You can get in touch with us anytime. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter at IPR Talk. I'm there too, at Charity Nebbe. And I also want to mention, coming up July 30th, we are having a celebration, and you're invited to the Horticulture Research Farm at Iowa State University. It's just outside of Ames. And we're celebrating the 30th anniversary of Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. It's at 1 o'clock. You can find out more information on our website. We would love to see you there. iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.